Welcome to Everyday Driver, where cars are more than just transportation. They're freedom, a common ground, a way to grow, and can even make life better. We're here to help everyone find a car they love and discover all the ways cars connect us. I'm Todd.
I'm Paul. And this is The Car Debate.
575 podcasts is a lot of you and I talking, and we have reached this place. Thank you guys for being with us.
I never know where you're going to start.
I know.
This
is part of the fun.
Push the record button, and
this
we
is
start.
Part of the fun. Yes, exactly. It is a lot of podcasts. Of course, we do number 600, which, of course, will be coming up later this year. We will do another live, all questions, nothing to do. Well, it's just going to be madness, because we always do it at the 100 marks. It's just lots of madness.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you'll see our faces on video. But this one is a all questions podcast related to cars. And you guys have come through for us. It's huge.
Yeah, thank you guys for being the core, the backbone of the podcast.
Yeah.
Your questions are what make the podcast. So thank you for generating all this stuff. We're excited to get to as many as we can, but if not, we've got a nice reserve to get to future podcasts as well. Some news real quick. Season 8 is now officially available on Amazon Prime. It is still playing. This is the first season. It's ever played on Motor Trend Cable Channel while simultaneously being available on Amazon Prime. Because we talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody says, guys, when is it going to be on streaming? It is on streaming
now.
No
one is more surprised than this guy right here. Because for whatever reason, in seasons past, the approval process has taken a while. And so I worked as fast as I could. I was actually simultaneously mastering for Amazon while we were mastering for TV. And typically, I get all the TV stuff out. This is behind-the-scenes
stuff.
Then I work on the Amazon stuff.
Yeah.
I was kind of going simultaneously. So the last episode had shipped to Discovery, and it had been gone about 10 days, and it was still 10 days from airing. And I was like, I'm going to put out the stuff to Amazon because it'll probably be a couple months until it's approved. 10 days later, Amazon approved it. They approved it essentially within the same 24-hour period of episode 6 of season 8 dropping. So it is now on Amazon. If you're international, it's also on Vimeo. You can watch season 8 right now on cable, on Amazon, on Vimeo. They're all there.
What, did they hire more approval people just
to get
it through?
I have no idea.
We've been waiting months.
I'm thrilled.
Before, we'll just take it. How about that?
It's great stuff.
Be quiet and just take it, and we're good. And I'm thrilled it is, because now you can see it the same time it's actually on TV, which
and
is
with
pretty
us
cool.
talking about it so much, we've been talking about it. We do have to get the TV episode to premiere before we get it other places. That's part of how we've kind of built the whole thing. But I'm so excited
Indeed.
That it's out, because
Indeed.
Now we're going to have this coming Saturday is the SCCA training episode that we did
last
season.
Right.
That's replaying this
Excellent.
Saturday. And then all six new ones of Season 8 are playing again through March on the Motor Trend Cable Channel. Not on the Motor Trend app, but if you want streaming, it's Amazon Prime or Vimeo.
We have some new merchandise on the Blip Shift store.
Yes, we do.
They are embroidered ball caps. They're black with the white embroidery, and I think they're awesome.
They look cool.
We have ordered ours.
Yes, we have.
And there's still some left.
Mm-hmm.
All you have to do is go to everydaydriver.com, and when you click the store tab, you've got the option to go to the Amazon web store, which is more jackets and Todd's novel and posters and things like that. But Blip Shift is, of course, all of our t-shirts and these new ball caps. So click the right tab there, go to Blip Shift and place your order. If they're very popular, we can always add more. We can always do it again. But
because they are limited edition. It's a little different than the typical Blip Shift thing. It's not just however many people order in a period of time. They actually have a limited number total that are available, so get them now.
The next episode after this, just as an FYI before we dive in, is a No Dumb Questions episode. And those are all the questions that kids, your kids, your significant other, friends, why do you like cars so much? What is it with you and cars? Why do you talk about all this stuff? Why wouldn't you just be quiet? Why don't you shut up about this all this stuff? It's those kinds of questions that we welcome for the next episode featuring Todd's wife.
Yes, she will be
introducing
here.
And Mrs.
Now,
Deacon to the
and
world.
Now she's gotten nervous, which I'm laughing about because she's an actress.
What?
She's been in front of thousands of people, and now she's nervous. I'm like, come on, it's gonna be fine.
There's nobody watching.
Exactly. It's gonna be great. She's gonna be great at it. But this is the thing. This is our kind of Valentine themed episode. We may do an all kids one later for like Father's Day, but this is intended for significant others that are going, I love you, but what is up with you in cars?
But what is
and
up?
Explain this to me. We're gonna have those conversations. My wife is going to look through the questions and ask me questions, and we're gonna talk about it. It's gonna be very interesting. I'm kind of going, let's see how this goes.
You've heard us talk about drive homework. because it's vital to drive a lot of things when trying to find your next car. Knowing your options is important. This applies to online shopping too. You don't want to search just one website unless that site is searching all of the other ones for you.
That's why we love AutoTempest. I know you've heard us talk about it before, and we hope you've already seen how far you can shop with just one search. AutoTempest pulls from all the top used car sites at once, so you know you won't miss a deal on that perfect car.
AutoTempest.com. All the cars, one search. This is great. We're going to dive right in. Starting on Facebook, Daniel B. is asking, well, first, he says, once every automaker eventually transitions to an all-electric fleet with electric motors and batteries from one of a handful of suppliers around the world, what will be left to differentiate vehicles from each brand? Daniel feels like driving characteristics of engines and transmissions is a huge part of what makes a brand right now. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, yeah.
Once every brand gets their powertrains from one of a few suppliers, it seems like suspension tuning and exterior styling will be the only thing left to differentiate the different brands in the market, especially as automakers move to having companies like Apple handle the in-vehicle infotainment systems. So the question here is, do we think most of the current manufacturers will be able to survive once we all move to electric vehicles that are more or less made from the same components? I want to ease your mind, first of all, Daniel. I want to put your mind at ease. Electric cars are 1.4% of sales right now as of this podcast recording. We know that because we asked our friends high up at Toyota, and they came back using their data of the market and said, this is about where we're at.
And isn't it like, if memory serves from that conversation, it was like 4% worldwide in general. It was like 4%.
4% that included all hybrids. But battery electric vehicles, BEVs, specifically those, I remember distinctly, they said it's about 1.4%. The news media would have us believe
it's happening tomorrow,
that it's all going to be wiped away, and that just isn't the case right now. And car companies know that they need to develop electric vehicles and new electric platforms.
Yeah, yeah.
But they also have platforms to support and a legacy of internal combustion engines to support.
Yes, yes.
That's just good business. There's no law there. That's just good business.
Well, and most of them will have to keep parts available. Here's the thing. If all of these fleets, and you cannot see my big "we'll see" air quotes that are happening as I say this, but if all of these manufacturers really do only make electric cars from 2035 on, I know that many are announcing things like that. If that really happens,
yeah. Right.
First off, that's 15 years away. There will be 15 years worth of new cars made and then new cars supported after 2035 if they make that category, that milestone anyway. So that's the first part, but there's lots of things to say. Keep going.
I still believe there's going to be a good mix, Daniel, of electric car availability and still internal combustion engines and of a lot of hybrids in between. But I also feel strongly, I'm a glass half full kind of a guy, all right?
Okay, all right.
That manufacturers are going to realize, again, with my rant before, once we get all the MPVs, the people movers, out to the market, customers are going to want fun cars. Even small amounts of the market, there will be money to be made and a business case to be made for the fun cars. This is why everybody loves cars, because they're fun. And the fun cars are fun. I know that sounds crazy.
It's weird how that worked. Yeah,
I don't think manufacturers will be well-liked enough to just build boring people movers.
I think we'll end up with two or three total to his question. If that's where everybody goes into, there's going to be massive consolidation and it's going to be probably half the manufacturers we have now.
Also,
if it went that way.
Yeah, very true. I like that point. Also think about the brands themselves, the brands that have flourished and are specifically pointed at enthusiast driving. It isn't just the Germans. It's not just Porsche and BMW and some Mercedes and some cool Audis. What about Alfa Romeo as a brand? What about Maserati as a brand? What about Fiat? They make fun stuff.
Sure, Abarth.
The subsidiary essentially as the fun part of that. What about all the how do you call it, the subcategories of a brand, the STs of the world, SRT versions of things, the AMG versions of things? Those brands exist within car companies. Specifically pointed at what? Not people moving. Not checking the box on the price and the features and
moving
the amenities.
Moving the fun meter, yeah.
You know, and we came in right at about $28,000 for the new car. No, it is specifically about fun.
I would like to think, excellent points. I would like to think that if everything had the same engine and drivetrain, there will still be variation in how they drive. And here are my reasons I think that. The Lotus lineup, the Elise and the Evora. One of them had a Corolla engine, the Elise, and the Evora has a Camry engine. Those don't drive like Corollas and Camrys.
It's a great point.
Also, let's go tangentially off of Toyota again, because they've essentially slept with everybody at this point. Subaru has their engine in the 86. That same 2-liter flat four has been in other Subaru products. Nothing else in the Subaru lineup drives like the BRZ 86. Nothing else. And there's the same exact engine. So it stands to reason that, hopefully, that the same drivetrain can create multiple different feels of cars based on weight, weight distribution, and, yeah, suspension tuning, these kind of things. Let's hope so. Now, we're not going to have difference in sound. They're all going to whir the same.
That's true. But I think there will be an enthusiast and even non-enthusiast sort of pushback on that. It's there will be plenty of people who don't like that. And to be honest, everybody who lives near a freeway or a road where there's trucks often, the trucking industry, yeah, bring that. That's great. Let's not have Jake brakes.
What about 100 electric vehicles all going by at the exact same whine? That's probably going to have its own issues. I'm just saying.
Glass
that's
just shatters
exactly.
constantly. No, I hear you about the
platform.
This
is a great condo, but you can only buy plastic.
Exactly. It's just Lexan windows everywhere. I hear you about the platform thing. It's just you're envisioning putting a sports car body on the same platform, and then a minivan body, and then a sedan body, and all that kind of stuff. Yes and no. I think the new Hummer is an indication of that'll be a different thing than even the pickup truck version. It'll drive differently
maybe.
And have different characteristics.
Let's hope so.
I think we're optimists here, but if nothing else, Daniel, think of the next 15 years of still fun cars coming at us. And what's that going to do to a legacy of cars on the road? I think the aftermarket industry will change dramatically, too, for the better.
Yeah. Bob McCormick has a question that you and I are going to disagree on. He's asking about paddle shifters. He's test-driven many cars with paddle shifters, and the ones on the steering wheel drive him nuts. He wants them on the column. You prefer the column. I prefer the wheel. The reason is because he keeps driving, and he loses track of which paddle is which when he's coming out of a corner. So he's thinking, why aren't there more column shifters? By the way, the Alfa Giulia has them on the column, big moose antler things on the column.
Indeed.
They do exist in some places, but he's just trying to figure out what's going on here. Bob, here's my question for you, and I'm asking honestly, where are your hands? Where are your hands on the wheel?
Sure.
And how do you do a turn? Are you a person that constantly shuffles? Do you do hand over hand? And I say this because I don't have a problem. I actually prefer them on the wheel. And the reason I prefer them on the wheel is because very rarely, and I'm saying one out of every like 10 corners, am I ever in a situation where my arms are so crossed, I don't still have a hand by one of the paddles I need. My hands are sitting there at 9 and 3, and man, 90-95% of the driving I will ever do, my hands are directly behind the paddles I need attached to the wheel. So if I turn left, right, I love that they're just right at my fingertips.
I hear you. That's a great point.
If you have them on the column and you do a hand-over-hand event, then they're locked down. You can always find them. And an automotive journalist, the two of us and many others, they will split the room on which they prefer. But I actually think the issue here is where are your hands and what kind of corners are you doing? Because the other thing about it is generally, if I'm driving a car with paddle shifters, let's go to track driving. I'm coming into a corner and I'm downshifting mostly in a straight line or maybe under a tiny bit of turning under trail braking. I'm not needing to shift in the dead middle of the corner.
Very true.
I'm downshifted before the corner. I'm doing the majority of the corner, not even needing a shift. And then I'm shifting as I'm bringing the wheel back straight. So I never really have a problem with where are the paddles. Everybody drives a little different. There are those that will argue a shuffle technique is every bit as fast as leaving your hands and locking over and all that kind of stuff. I'm not going to argue that with you, but I'm asking you about hands, mm-hmm. and I think that might change the situation. Also, when you need to shift changes it. Again, I also, like I'm restating it now, Bob, but I realize that I'm always downshifting in a straight line, and I'm always upshifting when I'm almost back to straight.
Yeah. No, I hear you. I will take this opportunity to clear something up, and that is the perception that I don't like paddle mounts on the steering wheel. I actually do. I do like that, generally speaking. Car manufacturers have now figured out that the right paddle is upshift, the left one is downshift. Mm-hmm. That is kind of an industry standard.
Thankfully.
Without any rules being written anywhere, mm-hmm. which is interesting. But I do hear your point. At low speed turns, yeah, your wheel is all the way over.
Like parking.
I do hear that, and you want to take a paddle, and it would be handy. Generally speaking, most of the Italian manufacturers do the column-mounted paddles.
That's a good point, yeah.
Really, pretty much across the board. Mm-hmm. Everybody else does the steering wheel mounts, generally speaking. But I do like the ones on my Cayman. And when it comes to higher speed driving, yeah, you're not shifting mid-corner. You're mm-hmm. shifting on the exit to a corner is probably mm-hmm. the soonest you'll shift. But mid-corner, let's not all try to be F1 drivers. Move your hands. Don't cross your arms in the X position. You don't need to. Move your hands and then let the wheel come back to center position and then find the paddle again. At low-speed corners, I hear your point. It is nice to have it there. Mm. But I will say, with the PDK transmission, you have the lever to be able to do that. So your wheel's all the way over. You don't know which paddle is which. You reach down and you use the lever instead.
Mm, okay.
Many cars besides Porsche have this as well. But I'm just saying it is a preference. But I actually do kind of like both. I really do appreciate the column mounts. And it is a different driving experience when I'm driving a car with the column mounts. I do like that a lot. It's not that I, just that's the only way I want it. Because I do like what Porsche offers. And I do like all that kind of stuff.
So. Paul wants to make sure we all know that the way Porsche is doing it, he's still fine with. Yes.
I really do like it all. Speaking of Porsches, John K. says, regarding the show from a few weeks ago, is it uncool to have a Porsche 356 copy or any other type of copy?
Mm.
Not at all. I aspire to a copy of a 356. I can't afford a 356, but a copy? Sure. I think there is no shame in that, and you're introducing, again, the continuation cars debate for the owners who have the rare Bentleys and Aston Martins mm-hmm. that are the rare, super high-end examples. I'd love it if Ferrari just said, go nuts with mm-hmm. the 62 Ferrari GTO.
Mm-hmm.
Would that devalue any of the real ones? No. We all know that the real one is very special and has racing provenance. Yeah. But I think it allows all of us enthusiasts to appreciate the brand more. I would encourage it.
The thing that we were both so enjoyed about those, if you will, kit cars, which is a dirty word among enthusiasts. Mm-hmm. You have a kit car. You built it in your garage. What are you doing? That's a little bit of a dirty word. But,
exactly.
But I come back to this reality. If you're buying it because you're a collector, it's a dirty word. If you're buying it to drive it, it's kind of perfect.
Which are more people than the collectors.
Because what you have now is the thing that looks like. This is the experience we had on PCH. It looks like the no one could ever afford it. Why do you have that out here car? But if I get a little bit of road rash, I don't care.
Okay.
I can just drive it. And now you're enjoying it. And you have, if you will, all of the benefits of driving that car and none of the potential downsides of either the buy-in cost or the, oh my gosh, what just happened?
Well, look, when we told people that those were replicas, they mm-hmm. saw those cars on the chute.
Yeah.
And they said, wow, is that real? And I'm like, no, it's a replica. That didn't faze them a bit. That didn't change their expression. They weren't suddenly crestfallen.
They didn't go back to their car.
No,
I won't take a photo anymore.
Exactly. They were still interested in it, and they still went, wow, you just don't see that. It mm-hmm. didn't matter mm-hmm. even a little bit.
It's a good point. It's a good
and
point.
If you had the real one, it wouldn't have ratcheted up because nobody can compute $20 million or more for a car.
Yeah.
What does that feel like? I don't know. Does it make me more or less interested? Not really. So when we told people that, nope, they're actually replicas, it didn't matter.
Mm, interesting.
The expressions didn't
change. You're right.
The mouths still hung open. So who cares?
The number of people that stopped to look at that vintage Speedster, which looked like a 356 and actually had Porsche badging on it. But if you looked close, the Porsche badge on the front, the crest mm-hmm. wasn't a Porsche crest.
Exactly.
It looked close. But honestly, as cool and as please notice me loud as that Daytona was, and I really liked it, the Porsche got more looks and more photos.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the far more accessible car. Indeed. I was very surprised by that for sure.
Indeed. Sean H. is asking, why do car companies create completely different and usually significantly smaller engines for turbo cars versus the naturally aspirated cars? Why not just turbo the existing engine?
Mm.
I believe that it's to justify the existence of the naturally aspirated engine. And many times, it's a legacy engine that's been around for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
It's a larger architecture. It's usually a V6. It's been in the lineup forever. They've invested all kinds of money in the tooling.
Mm-hmm.
And to justify still putting this in there, and many people do like that power out of a V6, we'll say, and they want the, you know, the lower end torque, or they just want that kind of feeling. It makes the car heavier, even though this tiny little four-cylinder will make more torque, we'll say.
Yeah.
But what that doing that smaller engine will allow them to do is be able to put that in more cars worldwide, rather in more markets, essentially, mm-hmm. to be able to appeal to, of course, fuel efficiency. But it allows them to put that, you know, around the world. In Ford's doing this is a great example. And they can put that engine in different mm-hmm. cars around the world and in different markets, as I said. And usually that V6, whatever it is, you don't hear of an inline four being naturally aspirated. And then they came along with a 1.5 turbo that just crushed the four and they still offer both. You don't hear of that.
True.
It's usually a six and it's been in the lineup for a long time.
Or an eight or a 12 or whatever. But the other thing about it is the other reason you don't take those bigger engines. Somebody has a question here. I'm sorry, I can't find your name now, but it directly relates to that. And that is, why does every manufacturer have a 2-liter engine, a 2-liter turbo? Why is that the magic?
Yeah.
It's tax laws. Yes. Not in the US, but elsewhere in the world, that 2-liter engine is the highest you can get before there's extra taxes on the car and extra mm-hmm. expenses to buy it in certain markets. So that's why everybody has a 2-liter four, and then they turbo it to get up to the power that they would have had in a 6 or a 12 or a whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
So that happens as well. Let's see. Right here, Anthony Zerg's got a question. 3 kids, he says, 7, 9, and 11. They are doing what kids do. They're growing. And they're arguing. So he needs to get a new family car for the next 6 years. He's considering a 5-seater with the biggest back seat he can get for 3 growing kids, or should he go find something 3-row? And if he does, then the only girl might have a respite from her brothers because she might be able to have a different row to herself.
Oh.
Anthony, I think you need to go 3-row. I think because also you have the issue of any kid brings a friend. Now you okay. now you're out of space.
Sure. Okay?
So I think you need to go 3-row. I'm also going to say this to you. If this is just family car duty, that's all it is. It's family car duty and hauling, and you're going to do road trips and that kind of stuff. I know you might be surprised to hear me say this, but also you need to look at minivans. You just do. They are the best for that job.
You're on a roll. You've recommended a Subaru Outback, and now you're talking minivans.
I have a question I want to jump off to exactly after this that's going to seem like I'm contradicting myself. But if your purpose, Anthony, is to have something to give the kids space that has longevity, it's hard to fight the minivan. There's some great 7-seat SUVs out there. I actually think what you should do is do 3 rows with captain's chairs. That way you can separate the boys.
Mm, okay.
And your daughter can sit in the back. And everybody's happy with a little bit of space. Or you relegate the boys to the back and she sits in one of the captain's chairs. You could do that too. Okay? But I think you go with a 3-row. I think that's worthwhile. But Sharif asks a related question. He says, hang on. Because of our love of the GLS AMG 63, the big monster 7-seater that operates like a supercar, that got him thinking about when buying a family car, should we, the collective we, all of us, be shopping for something fun there too? I know this is going to sound like I'm contradicting my last answer, but in short this, Sharif, vehicles are expensive. The reason we say tool for the job is because we like you to have different things that can actually play to their strengths. The minivan's strength is just, I have space. Everybody has plugins for their phone and headphones and a screen. I have space. We're going to do a family road trip. Which is not the Lotus Elise strengths, which is why I did that Spectrum of Sacrifice piece. They are quite different.
My favorite was the minivan door opening to reveal the
to
Lotus.
To reveal the Elise. I enjoyed that as well. That was just so fun. Like,
the car you're in, the car
the
you
car
want.
You want.
Close. You should have had this, the door close on your dream. It just closes on the dream.
Charisse, I think you need to find something that you as a driver like no matter what your area you're buying in, which is what this show's all about.
Yeah.
And that could be the minivan. But here's the thing. You could take your minivan and put better tires on it and improve it.
Mm-hmm.
If you go, the van is what I need, you as an enthusiast can still look at that and go, what do I as a driver need out of this, though? The thing I love about the GLS AMG 63 that you and I have started talking about at length, Paul, is I kind of feel like crazy performance should go to that world.
Mm-hmm.
The really ridiculous performance that we cannot believe it's that fast, corners that well, consumes that much gas, makes that much noise, has that big an engine. Oh, my gosh, did you see the power number on this? Let's put that in the family seven-seater.
It needs to go to trucks and SUVs. That's where it's gone.
So that we can have small, light, doesn't need to be powerful little sports cars that we can actually ring out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that I can drive something as fast as it will go and still be in range of the speed limit and actually use the gears because it's got 200 or 300 horsepower.
Yeah, but and what we're going to have to get used to is those big minivans with a lot of power and SUVs will mostly be able to keep up, if not continue to keep up as the sports car.
Okay, but I'll go.
Will happen.
I'll go here. Your Airbus that you recently rode in, your 737 you rode in, a 747, they're fast.
Yeah.
Sheer numbers, they are fast.
Sure, sure.
Go drive a Cessna. Go fly a Cessna. Go fly a P-51 Mustang. Go fly a biplane. Go fly an acrobatic plane. Guess what? All of the jets got you there quicker.
Yeah, they're all faster. Yeah.
But it's the small, lightweight stuff, even in aircraft. That's the stuff that you connect with and go, I'm actually involved, and this is really crazy, and wow.
Are you telling us we have to go barnstorming with sports cars now? Is that the whole point?
Let's do that.
Eric McNeil asks us about car myths. Which ones do we dislike the most? It can be about the auto industry, a specific manufacturer, a specific model. I do have some, Eric. You've opened up a can of worms here.
Uh-oh.
I say... Well, I see this mostly on YouTube comments.
Okay.
And that is still, Hyundais and Kias are garbage. Korean cars suck. They don't. German cars are money pits. We're doing a cheap sports car challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Currently disproving that.
Mm-hmm.
The cars are 1-to-1 right now. They're both running.
Yes.
They're both strong.
Yes.
They start, they run. Mm-hmm. They've been running for a while. The mileage is piling on them. They're good.
I have had 3 winter cars that have parked outside in the last few years. No, 4. The Lancer, the Subaru, the FRS didn't park outside. The Lancer, the Subaru, the Mini, I'm going to go 5, the Phaeton, and the BMW Z4.
Okay.
All of them have parked outside in the worst of Park City winter.
Yeah.
And the one that starts the easiest every single time is the Z4.
I mean, you did pour a bunch of stop leak into the Phaeton.
I did.
There's a lot of stop leak goo in that engine.
Yes, but my point is that the Z4, the BMW money pit, springs to life.
It does. It does.
It doesn't matter how cold it is. Like, let's go.
Yep.
Let's do it.
I found the same thing with the SLK. It has a weird... I think the battery's starting to go, but that's just usage. That's just cold and usage. But once it starts, it's been sitting a while. It's a slow to start kind of thing, but then... Once it's going, it's just ready to go. Warms up fast. We're ready to go. Everything works on this car.
Mm.
I'm amazed by this.
Yeah,
I did have a reliable Maserati too, but you know,
reliable because you ignored those things which were going wrong. But yes, I take your point,
Eric. The other myths are sitting up high is safer. Disagree.
Mm.
Disagree.
Mm.
I will go toe to toe with anybody who wants to tell me sitting up high is safer.
You could enjoy that conversation with my wife on Friday.
I just might. The one that is no replacement for displacement, you can't say that one anymore.
That's a good point.
Yeah. That one is old news. I hate to say
good point.
I love V8s. I love V12s.
Yes. Yes. Big engines are crazy fun.
But a hot turbo 6 is going to take you.
Mm-hmm.
They make more torque. Even a 4-cylinder, that hot 4-cylinder, Mercedes AMG does this now.
Yeah, you're right.
You cannot tell me there's no replacement for displacement anymore.
Along those lines of speed, David Elfring is asking on Facebook, will the speed and immediacy of sporty electric vehicles overwhelm drivers? Can we react fast enough to drive them in race conditions? First off, I think we are adaptable as beings and we can figure it out. The thing I'm worried about is the crazy amount of power under your right foot if you aren't actually involved. I'm not worried about those of us that want to drive them hard and are drivers that are dedicated to driving. I'm worried about the random people that are half paying attention to their driving.
Yeah.
That's the concerning part, because they're going to get going faster than they expected, sooner than they expected. And this is the reason. Here's the bait and switch that's happening, though. This is the reason, Tesla leading the charge here, that this crazy powerful electric world is being married with autonomy ideas. So even though they're becoming more powerful, they're asking us to do less. I'm not saying this is the right idea, but I think it's fascinating that both of those are starting to happen simultaneously. You have more power, faster, and we're taking it away from you.
Tesla leading the charge, really?
Sorry, that was an accidental. But I think it'll be really interesting to see, in general, we've hit on it a couple times already, a sporty electric vehicle.
Yeah.
We've driven the Tesla Roadster, which is a stretched out Elise.
It's so heavy and not good to drive.
It's not good to drive. It's surprisingly fast.
It's fast.
It's incredibly fast.
It's not good to drive.
But it feels like my Elise dragging something behind it.
Something large.
Yes, it's got an anchor.
It's not good to drive.
Using my Elise as a tow vehicle. It yes. just feels really weird. Cars are made to be driven. And we can't imagine a future without driving cars we really love. Luckily, the folks at Hagerty feel the same way. That's why they support this show. One of the many things Hagerty offers for people who love cars is insurance for their enthusiast vehicles. But that also includes classic cars, trucks, motorcycles, collectibles, and even boats.
They also protect raced vehicles off the track and can even insure vehicles on the track for HPDE events and track days. In fact, we use Hagerty Track Day Insurance every time we drive the Cayman and Elise on our local track, and it adds huge peace of mind.
Learn more about Hagerty and quote insurance at Hagerty.com/everydaydriver. I've got a fighting words question here. I'm going to get emails. I know I am.
Oh, yeah?
Track Daily Crush off-road four-wheel drive edition. Do you see this?
Oh.
Derek wrote in. He said, Jeep Wrangler, Ford Raptor,
oh,
Toyota FJ.
Yes, I did see that, yeah.
Track Daily Crush off-road edition. I would daily the Raptor, I would off-road the Wrangler, and I would crush the FJ. And the reason is because, and I'm going to get FJ letters. I know. There's
the FJ community is
they're
out
gonna,
for
they're
you.
Gonna write, they're going to write in. The reason is this. The Toyota FJ, when we were in Moab with a Wrangler, we couldn't believe how many FJs we saw that looked stock, that were just running everything everybody else was running. It's not that they aren't capable. It's that they have terrible visibility. I don't want to daily that car. And I'd rather have the Wrangler off-road. The back three quarter from the B-pillars back in the FJ is genuinely very bad visibility-wise, whereas the Raptor is this big thing with a bubble on the top and you can see everybody.
Piece of Left Bugs is asking which car brand we wished we liked more. Fiat's up there, just generally speaking. I like the Abarth, but just generally as a brand, I kind of wish I liked them more. Alpha, no, I already like them a lot. I like Alpha a lot. What else? Lincoln has come back in a big way. They're just going all SUVs. They're going, you know, really big. You know what? I wish I liked Range Rovers more.
Okay.
We rarely, if ever, recommend Range Rovers of any style, shape, year, model, color, anything.
Okay.
We don't really talk about Range Rovers much. I guess I wished I liked them more. But look, they've got great design. They're very clean, very beautiful. The interiors are very minimalist. They should totally appeal to me. I just have this yucky taste in my mouth when I think of Range Rover.
Okay.
This is me getting angry letters from the Range Rover community.
Yeah. People are writing. It's fine, yeah.
After I read that the 06 Discovery Sport had extra weight added to it to negate some high-speed road frequencies, 42-pound blocks of weight hanging behind the rear wheels. After I read about this,
that's a solve.
I didn't like them anymore. Why do this?
Okay.
They're cool-looking. They're apparently the world's most capable off-road vehicle that nobody ever tests.
That is the marketing material, yes.
And now they're just, you know, we test them on the ring. Why do Range Rovers need to be hooned around the ring?
This is an excellent question.
I don't get it.
I will agree with you on that.
The interiors are gorgeous. They seem really well built upon initial inspection. and I see the Defender 110 driving around. There's a bunch of them here in Park City.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think, cool, yeah, no, there's a bunch I would buy before that. I would just buy almost every pickup before that thing.
Interesting.
And I'm not into pickups.
Okay.
8% of me is.
But 8% of you is,
You know, I don't care. Who is that for? Apparently the people driving around in them.
Apparently those people.
I guess it's Ranger.
While we're making people angry, I'll just continue. Forrest Jenkins says, do you ever see a car on the road and it just makes you angry? What's a car that when you see it, it makes you angry?
Oh, I know this one.
He says, for instance, when I see certain cars, and he lists off the cars for him. I'll tell you, I thought about, there's one that every time I see it, I just, it's not that I'm angry, but I'm just instantly struck by why.
Oh, no, I know it's anger.
Well,
it's,
no, why? It's, I don't know if you're going to talk about what I'm thinking.
I know.
But here's the one. Every time I see one, I don't understand why you picked that car. I'm going to get an angry letter. It's the Infiniti QX80, the Narwhale.
Oh.
The Narwhale. Because
I was thinking of.
Were you thinking Outback?
No, I was thinking of the Fiat 500, that
long, oh, the squishy. X.
No, the, no, the what's the...
The 500X.
Is it the 500X?
Yes.
That's the small one on the Renegade chassis. What's the big bloated...
That comes in a flesh color?
Yes.
Separate thing. No, the QX80, the problem with the QX80, because the Outback, for example, I make fun of the fact that my son and I count them and we see dozens everywhere we go, but...
He told me yesterday, by the way, he was like, let me tell you the latest body count.
Yeah.
It's like, you're still counting these things?
But look at our test drive on the Outback. We actually go through why we know it sells. And how it lives in a weird vortex of the market by itself. So I at least, I wish they weren't so ubiquitous, but I at least understand it. The QX80 I don't get. It's not inexpensive. If you're buying a luxury SUV, I do not understand why your money went to Infiniti. The amount that thing costs, you have overlooked so many others that are more attractive, better built, better to drive.
Mm-hmm.
That every time I see a QX80, I am baffled by why.
I'm pulling at my collar now.
I know. I'm getting letters. I'm getting letters.
Although I admit, I did go off on our 2020 QX80 review, encouraging Infiniti to throw them all out, stop making everything, introduce some new cool thing for the future. They've teased us forever. Mm. They used to have an F1 partnership. They've got tech. They've got a big company behind them. What is keeping them from introducing coolness?
Nissan is replacing their entire lineup in like the next 5 minutes, so maybe something's coming.
Barmalot is asking if there are any circumstances where we think it's worth buying a car and bring a trailer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Hmm. I'm not sold.
Okay.
I'm not sold. I think the bring a trailer effect has infected every auction.
Okay.
Regardless of the car. Because now you look at something you would have never, ever considered, and you think, oh, I guess those are starting to go back up now.
It has morphed our perception of what we actually think is reality. That is true, yeah.
I'm kind of going with no.
Okay.
Because now Bring a Trailer has turned into the spotless perfect example of the obscure thing you never thought would be worth money.
Yes, it has become that place of random obscurity.
Like, oh, an old Panzer. What? Huh. I didn't know those were going back up. Oh, that's a lot of money. I think it's now voyeurism for price.
Interesting. Okay.
Can you believe what this costs? Now look at what some idiot paid for that.
Yeah.
Wasn't me.
And then somebody buys a car you can't believe for $250,000 and you know it will never get driven again. That's what makes me sad.
I'm going with no.
I'm going to say there is a reason. There is a reason. I think, look, Bring a Trailer has brought amazing cars out of obscurity. And it has become, literally, in a weird way.
A compliment.
Way, seriously, in a weird way. Look, you and I feel a little differently about this, but we've had people ask us about our thoughts on Bring a Trailer, so I'm going to unpack it a bit. It's brought amazing cars out of obscurity. It has spawned other things. Like, let's be honest, Cars and Bids would not exist without Bring a Trailer existing.
Fair enough.
Bring a Trailer has gone upmarket, so Cars and Bids from Doug DeMuro has slipped in underneath it.
Yeah.
So you have this world. Stuff has come out of garages and been sold that you can't even believe that car exists. And we get to see it's become, this is going to sound weird, it's become the fire that all of the enthusiasts kind of stand around and go, ooh.
It's the community campfire.
It is. It's the community campfire.
We're warming our hands over somebody else's
going,
cash burning
wow,
up.
Wow. The difficulty, though, is it has also brought out, I think, the worst of YouTube commenter-style comments, but now it's the know-it-alls on Bring a Trailer telling you, well, that fourth rivet down shouldn't be. It's a car. Buy it. Drive it. But from a buyer perspective, I think it makes it very difficult to sell one on there. But from a buyer perspective, I think if you're buying something that isn't the most pristine example of whatever, it's just a solid example. And there will be others. There's been three or four others this year already, and there'll be three or four behind it. You can find a nice one, well-loved, well-documented on Bring a Trailer. It's the random unicorns. I think it creates a world that is nowhere connected to reality. And I think for somebody that's selling a car that they just drove and loved, like I would never sell my Lotus on Bring a Trailer. I'll get destroyed. Because I have a ton of miles, it's got a ton of wear, it's been used and loved.
People will point out every rock chip on that thing.
Of which there are many because I drove it, okay?
Yeah.
So I think if you're that person selling that car, it's hard. I think if you have a mid-level, nice version of something that you can find, you're going to find a great one there.
Look, Porsche 356 Speedster replicas are about the same on Bring a Trailer as they are used anywhere else. Mm-hmm. They're about $30,000, $40,000. $40,000 is a decent one.
Okay.
We've seen replicas, vintage Speedster replicas, go for about $40,000 on Bring a Trailer. So, okay.
Yeah.
But I ask you at this point, what is the point? What's the point of using Bring a Trailer if they're the same price?
Oh, interesting. Okay. All right.
Conversely, the nice ones, the unicorns that you're talking about, okay, yeah, auctions. I'm all for auctions and proliferating and preserving cars. And the problem is people don't drive them because those nice ones are like the Acura NSX with 9 miles, and that'll go into somebody's collection and
sit. It's the sitting that frustrates me the most, yeah.
But I like that these cars are preserved, but it's the Porsche 911 effect has now happened to everything, and it's Bring a Trailer's fault.
Interesting. Interesting point. That you're talking about the air-cooled 911 explosion that happened in the early 2000s has now proliferated everybody. I take that.
Name the thing.
I take that. That's interesting. And, but I think it's because it is the enthusiast campfire we're all standing around.
I'm telling you, we're warming our hands on other people's cash burning up. YG Auto Detailing asks, why do most cars have chrome trim around the windows?
You're trying to explain why?
Bright work sells.
Good luck.
Bright work sells. Highlight, shiny. We're like raccoons.
We are.
We won't let go of the piece of aluminum foil.
We really are raccoons.
To our detriment. Mm-hmm.
We eat too much.
Bright work, the ding, cling, that bright work sells. Especially in a showroom when there's a piece of, you know, nice, shiny, whatever. I like that people are requiring that less. But it was always associated with some sort of touch of luxury, some sort of higher end kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And when mid-level to low-end cars started doing it a lot, well, that sells cars. Mm. There's a lot of what will sell? How do we sell this thing? Involved in the car design, you know, trim package, that kind of thing. Once they get past the design, once everything is done, we would prefer, you know, like a brushed nickel. And a subtle hairline stainless on the interior.
Okay,
and some carbon fiber tasty bits over here. And some nice leather and Alcantara and you know, that kind of stuff. I get that. But a dull titanium isn't going to sell as well unless you know what it is.
Interesting. Okay.
It's a lighter, more expensive, more durable material.
Interesting. Yeah.
You've gotten me into the honesty of materials too. And there's a question I want to continue from Peter G., asking about wood in the interior. Peter says, why do car makers still use wood trim or faux wood trim in 99.9% of cars? Peter thinks it's ugly, out of place in modern cars, looking like veneer or even worse, plastic. In most cases, he tries to hold on to the past, but he's yet to see a car where wood trim looks good, and even if it does look good, looks like it belongs in the car. Volvo probably does it best with their ivory wood, but other than that, he doesn't see the reason for it. Most people buying cars today never owned a car with real wood in it. Classic cars are another story. I think what you're talking really about, Peter, is the thickness of wood. With modern crash standards, you have to have veneer. You cannot have a thick plank, even an eighth of an inch thick. Imagine the splinters in an accident. Imagine that breaking and some manufacturer being sued because your big piece of wood that looks really nice. Splintered into 1,000 pieces, you get the idea.
Yikes.
Even Rolls-Royce and Bentley on their IPs, those are still thin bird's eye veneer, very, very thin. It's going to crumble before it does anything else in an accident. It is the perception since the very beginning. Materials matter. And just like wood in your home, it warms things up. It's less clinical. It's less antiseptic. Mm. It's a nice, warm, inviting, cozy place to be. We spend so much time in our cars. And I will agree with you on Volvo, but Mercedes is really doing well with their wood.
Mm.
It's nice, but it's thin, and it has to be thin. It has to be glued to a piece of plastic
so
it won't shatter, so you don't have shards or, you know, big slivers of wood. It seems like, why don't we have real wood? Let's make it like a piano in there. We can't.
You shattered the math. It's coming at you.
It's because of all those crash standards. That's why we've got to go to that thin veneer. And again, it'll crumble. But I still think wood has its place. It's the high end, the ultra. Mm. But Mercedes AMG is the ones doing it right. Really okay. Right.
All right. Tacked Out says, do I have a problem? I enjoy my winter beater, a 500 Abarth, a Fiat 500 Abarth, more than my Focus RS. Why is he like his Fiat more? I don't think you have a problem. A couple of things going on. First off, the Fiat. Watch our original review. I described that as owning a baby dragon, which is both good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
This has some of the most personality of any modern car. So the Fiat 500 has a ton of personality, and I think it has more personality naturally than the Focus RS does. It also rides better. The Focus RS has got a difficult ride. But here's my other thought on why I think you like the 500 Abarth better. You can use everything it can do all the time. And the Focus RS, you can't.
Mm, okay.
It's got more capability than your typical commute is ever going to require. The 500 Abarth, you can probably find a moment where you're just like, I am asking everything this car will give. And that is genuinely fun. I know it's a slow car, fast cliche, but truthfully, if you drive a hugely capable supercar slowly through traffic, it loses a lot of its luster. If you drive a, I can't believe this thing can go this fast, marginal performance car down a back road, you will cackle because you're actually wringing it all out. I think that's why the Abarth's speaking to you more.
Mm. Adam M. asks, what will be the next piece of automotive design to vanish completely? He uses the example of pop-up headlights. Pop-up headlights vanished.
Mm-hmm.
But that was because of tech. Mm-hmm. And you want that low silhouette, that low profile with giant clunky square or round headlights back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. You did the pop-up headlight thing. So that means it was all based around tech. So what piece of tech in the car is going to change so that this reflection of that tech will disappear? It's grills.
Oh, okay.
It's the grill on a car that is the giant air intake to cool the car as internal combustion engines make a lot of heat. And as electric cars proliferate, I think grills will disappear completely.
Interesting. Okay. I've got a an LA question. Kojo88 asked this question on Instagram. Do you see this? An LA professional with a midlife crisis would typically buy a 911. You're right.
I love that you're tackling this, by the way.
You're right. This is the thing that happens. This is the progression of Los Angeles, especially the Los Angeles film studio culture. I'm barely in Los Angeles. I got here last week.
The film studio culture.
I'm driving the Honda Civic that barely runs, that I've had since college, that barely runs, but I'm here. I'm an intern. I'm the PA, third PA on the left. I bought the wrong butter this morning. This is who I am, all right?
At least that.
But I'm here.
Yeah.
They go BMW, probably a 3 Series, generally in silver or black. That's where that goes. Of course, now, though, you can go Model 3. You're in the similar category.
Of course,
You can go there, too, or Model Y. But the next step up, you either go Range Rover or 911, depending upon who you are, also in silver or black. He's saying, if I want to branch out and not be that guy that bought the 911, what do I get? You have to ask yourself how much you don't want to be like everybody else. Okay, because look at me and my ridiculous hair choices. I don't want to be like everybody else, okay? So I would buy something ridiculous, but this is my assumption. If you're actually looking at buying a 911 in Los Angeles, a new one, you're probably shopping at about $150,000.
Easy.
There's a lot of choices there. I'm going to give you a few that I think are all more interesting than the 911. Now, let me be clear. The 911 drives brilliantly. The 911 is great to commute in. It's great to drive fast. It's great to sit on the studio lot and just be there. It looks very nice sitting still. It's perfectly good to get Starbucks. There's genuinely nothing wrong with the 911.
Mm-hmm.
It's just bought for status. But here's what's odd. Yeah. It's bought for status. I realize plenty of people buy a 911 and drive it well. I'm saying the LA thing is you bought it for status, but it's that weird LA studio thing. I'd like you to bring me a movie that is like something I've already seen, slightly tweaked. The 911 is the safe choice that people are going to buy because, oh, you got a sports car, but you got the same sports car that is approved by culture to get as a sports car.
Mm. Okay, okay.
I'm probably going to get more angry letters. This is what the whole podcast is about. Here's other options for you. Get yourself a Mercedes AMG GT.
Oh,
get yourself an Audi R8, an Aston Martin Vantage, or an Acura NSX. Stand out from the crowd. Get one of those in a color. Pull onto the studio lot with pride. I drive this car. You may have a 911 in front of you and a Range Rover behind you. Be the guy in the orange NSX. Be the guy in the green Mercedes GT.
Yeah.
Come on.
Although, doesn't Michael Bay drive crazy stuff? He's kind of
probably
into cars.
He had a. He was known for his Ferrari 550 for a while, and then he put it in a movie and many other things. He's doing about everything.
That's right.
But I'm saying the studio executive culture, you're limited to a certain number of cars.
ADS Diecast Art is asking if we've noticed the build quality differences from the newest generation vehicles to the prior. Hmm. The example is the Mark VI Jetta TDI. He specifically mentioned the TDI's massively better build quality than the new generation. It seems like we're slowly, the collective we, are losing quality for technology, and it's upsetting because he really enjoys the Volkswagen Jetta, but there is no way to buy a new one with its horrible build quality. I'm wondering what specific thing you're looking at, and I come back to the door slam. That tells you a lot about a car, but that
it's a door is what it tells you. Sorry, go on.
No, it tells you everything else. If they don't care about how the door thunks closed, what else don't they care about?
Don't ask that question about the Elise. It's got a rattle can close. Moving on.
Well, I'll give Lotus a hall pass. They're in a separate category. It's trim, I think. It's the use of plastics. But ultimately, it's about buying. It comes back to selling cars. We've got to sell cars. We've got to keep the price down. And so the designers, engineers might lose a battle. If they want some other new cool feature about the car to improve it, to do better at driving, to whatever it does, they're going to lose the battle with the business team saying, well, then, okay, you got to keep our costs down over here with the use of these plastics, and we're going to use some automotive adhesives here. That's going to be a little bit less expensive way of assembling the car, and we're going to assemble it in 7 sub-assemblies and glue it all together on the assembly line. And we've never done that before, but we're going to do it.
Okay.
Hi, Tesla.
Yes.
It actually happened. Anyway, I think it comes down to trying a new art, a new technique on your final art piece.
It's bound to go well.
It's that kind of thinking. Many times car manufacturers will use that, even though we've, you know, proven it out, and we're always trying to save money, because torturing a material into the thing you want it to be is what's the most expensive part of the car. That and putting it together and paying the people to put it all together. So wherever you can take money out of that process will save money on the bottom line. And I definitely understand that's always being looked at constantly. And we as consumers feel that. It's reflected in the price, and then, you know, we're saddled with that essentially. So the thing that we liked about the other one, well, some, you know, analyst got a hold of that piece of plastic and that trim and said, let's use fewer fasteners. Let's cut the cost without understanding or caring about what that does to our perception of the vehicle.
Kevin asked on Twitter, what are cars worth buying a poor example of so you can say you had the experience of owning one? Not a forever car, just bought it for the summer and enjoyed it. Well, Kevin, keep in mind, we bought ridiculously cheap sports cars and ridiculously cheap sedans just to drive them for a year. I encourage this in any market segment that intrigues you. Just be surprised by what you can find. Okay? But what I would say to you is, one I can think of right away is the Honda S2000. Buy an early S2000 that's not that expensive, doesn't have to be in perfect shape. It's going to still be reliable, and you have a moment-in-time car experience for not a whole lot of money, and you'll probably sell it for about what you bought it for.
Okay, fair enough. Ronald Harrison on Twitter is asking about the styling of the Cadillac CTS-V before it was But now it's morphed into the hubba hubba with the CTS-5 Blackwing.
Okay.
So what happened? Is there any particular styling detail that changed this ugly duckling into a swan? There's four. Fender flares.
Okay.
Fender flares.
Okay.
Fender. Just that swollen bit of muscle.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
And going from the crisp edge, and we're defining the surface and really sticking true to that, which is important for the brand, for styling, going to, let's let it all hang. Let's go a little bit wider stance.
Okay.
Let's flare. Let's add some mass to that surface. Mm-hmm. You want it swollen. You bring that out a few millimeters. You want to add the fender flares. That's where it starts to feel muscly and
interesting.
More underneath. Okay. When designers start to do that, when they're allowed to start doing that,
sure.
Management,
sure.
That's when we get things like the Blackwing.
Ryan's asking a question that I think is much broader and much more universal than specifically the way he's asking it. He has a 16-year-old Porsche Boxster.
Love it.
And he's saying, are my expectations too high? Am I expecting it to be too much of a daily driver and too much of a do-it-all? He goes between loving and hating it, and he admits that part of that is because he bought an old Boxster for cheap, and there was a lot of stuff he had to do to get it right.
Mm-hmm.
But now he just can't shake the feeling that he needs a couple of cars because driving the Boxster daily, he keeps finding things it's not good at. Here's the point I want to make. This is the reason that we talk about tool for the job. Let your cars, if you have multiple cars, if you as a family have the family hauler and the fun car, that's fine. They don't need to all be family haulers. Let the family hauler, if it needs to be a minivan because nothing hauls like a minivan.
Yeah.
There's more fun if you can actually allow yourself more fun, but play car's strengths. There's nothing wrong with that. But the flip side of that is if you have one car, you're going to wind up in situations where you're just like, this is really not good for this. The minivan on the back road. The small sports car at Home Depot. You're going to be thinking that it's going to kind of be funny. You're trying to hustle your minivan down a back road and going, this is terrifying. It's become funny because it is so terrifying. Okay. Or you're at Home Depot like I am with something like a Lotus going, better buy something small. Can't buy that.
It's nuts and bolts today.
Exactly right. I got to go to the aisle that I can put it in my pocket because otherwise we're not getting home. So
a can of bug spray.
You kind of have to embrace that. I don't think it doesn't take anything away from your single car ownership as long as you do with that car the things it's good at regularly. If you have a really compromised sports car like an Elise and all you do is commute in it, you probably need something else because you're never doing the thing that's going to make you go, oh, this is great doing this. So you have to give the car the opportunity to do what it's great at. So maybe you aren't ever doing that, Ryan. I don't know. Maybe you're never getting that opportunity. But then that hopefully will allow you, just like with people, we find their flaws, but we love their strengths.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully if you are embracing the things that your Boxster does really well, then you'll have moments when it's just like, this Boxster's not great for this, but it's the car I have.
Archer Millworks loves the Chevy SSR, he says, which makes his wife think he's smoking something.
Okay.
Is there a car that one of you loves that makes the other think you're huffing glue? Mm-hmm. It's the Lancer Rally Art that Todd loves that I think he's just... Hey, I think you're high for loving that car.
Well, the Isuzu Viacross
that
is
too.
A level beyond that.
You're absolutely
I
right.
I like
Thank
that.
You.
And you're like, I, you almost want to disown me as
gigantic
a friend.
Gigantic
yeah.
question mark over the top of my head with that one.
Yep.
Why on earth do you like that thing?
you get like what wordless and baffled every time.
I'm
yeah.
baffled by that thing. Why does it exist?
And why do I think it's cool?
Why do people like it?
Yeah, I know. I know it happened. Damn it, Patton says, do we ever think used car prices are going to level out? We actually have gotten some comments on our cheap sports cars piece because all the cheap sports cars we had in that piece, you can't get any of them now for those prices.
That's amazing.
In general, amazing. The used sports car prices, used car prices in general have spiked across the board. Sports cars even worse. I think this only has to settle out. It may be a couple years from now, but I think they're going to take a turn and start coming back down. The really unique stuff... The moment in time stuff is probably only going up.
Yeah, because bring a trailer and get a hold of it.
But the general stuff, like, and I'm referring to sports cars that they made a lot of. Think about Miatas and Mustangs and 86s and this kind of stuff. That's going to take back a turn in used car prices once, I don't know, new stuff's being built.
Mm. Tom at Gumby says, what's the worst rental car an airport has ever given you?
Oh, no.
A Mitsubishi Lancer. Base.
The base one? Yikes, that is terrifying.
Oh, was it bad? The seats were bad. The styling was bad. The color was bad.
It didn't go well.
That thing.
Along those lines, the Hudsonian says, what's the best car for a masochist? I think it might be the Morgan three-wheeler.
Oh.
I think it might be the Morgan three-wheeler.
Anything with Lucas Electrics?
Well, that's a whole separate problem. Yeah, get home before dark. That's up there. That's a good one as well. That's pretty good.
Guys, thank you so much for all your questions. Really, we mean it. We love doing this. These one-offs. They're so much fun.
There's a whole other podcast worth of questions here. I've got my sheet is still half full of questions. For sure. It's amazing. Thank you guys for being with us. It's fantastic.
We're definitely looking forward to next time. Cheers, everyone.